This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Myla Goldberg. We're here to talk about her new book, Wicket's Remedy. It's published by Doubleday. You know, one of the books that has had an afterlife that's very strong, Bee Season is still a book that people talk to me about, even several years after they've read it. And Wicket's Remedy is the new book by the author of Bee Season. And I think that once again, part of its virtue is its unpredictability, that for a very long time in reading this book, it's not quite clear where it's going to go. You know, a character gets married, but several pages later, her husband dies and she's back at home. Another character is excited about enlisting in the army. A few pages later, he catches the flu, and we're at a wake. So the book seems to have a very odd method of moving forward or of blocking forward motion. And I wanted to ask you about that first.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly, I didn't set out thinking that that's what was going to be happening, I think, on a large scale. I think I was fascinated, you know, by the scale of this catastrophe that I had never heard of. And I just wanted to really just insert myself into a situation like that and see what that world would be like. And I think, I guess, because that was, writ large, an example of forces beyond human control kind of inflicting themselves on people, this became a story about people, the struggle between, you know, persons trying to exert their personhood against forces that are larger than them, and the compromises that you by necessity have to end up making, the struggle between individuality and a larger world that's not necessarily going to be obliging, you know, your own ideas.
Now, it seems that on every level that disinclination to oblige takes shape. One of the characters has an idea to have a metaphysical remedy. Essentially, there'll be a bottle with a sugar liquid in it, preferably not bitter, but those who order it will receive a friendly letter, and it's the commiseration and solace that's meant to do the healing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That doesn't succeed.
No, but it's a fine idea. I mean, and I think there's something to be said there. I mean, we don't know where help is going to come from, and I think, you know, this character realizes that. He has kind of a personal experience that makes him realize that help in his life came from an unexpected source. And so, you know, you never know where the hurt is going to come from, and you never know where the help is going to come from. And so he was kind of trying to grapple with that idea in the form of this strange and ultimately perhaps, you know, failed remedy situation.
And what's more, a partner who comes along steals not his idea but the useless formula.
Right.
So that's the corporate level of
right,
the book.
Right.
On the level of medicine, all of the vaccines they're trying in the flu pandemic turn out to be hopeless. A special project to examine how the flu is transmitted
right.
turns out not to only to be futile, but somewhat sadistic
right.
in its mechanics. It does seem as if for this book, there's nothing that will ultimately save the little people, at least, mm-hmm. who are at the center of it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you make it sound so dark and sad, which it is. I mean, I guess you're right. It's true. And I guess that's for one reason, and it's interesting. I'm not sure how much I got this to work as well as I would have liked to, but the voices that chime in from the margins, I actually sort of see them as beacons of light in a way, kind of the magical bit, the kind of the fantastical element that I inject into this story is the idea that there is this sort of passive agency that is affected by these strange voices that come from the vortex, you know, of the beyond, and they do end up affecting things in the world of, you know, the living. And so it's almost too late, some of the little people who didn't perhaps have agency, you know, in life, get some agency in some small, perverted way. And I found hope in that. But,
uh-huh. Well, it seemed more like they're all dead.
Yeah.
And they're speaking. Sometimes they're heard. It's said that the flu and the weakened state allow these transmissions from the beyond to be heard. But most of the people seem to be saying, no, you've forgotten entirely.
Right.
I wore a blue dress, not a red dress.
Right.
No, I was the African American elevator operator,
right,
and no one ever noticed me.
Yeah.
It seems to be more the chorus of people saying, I get my final chance to leave a little chip on the slate,
mm-hmm,
you know, this, please remember me correctly.
Right. No, that's true. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's funny because while there's a lot of depressing stuff that happens in this book, I guess the point for me was, even if the larger picture is depressing, I don't think, for example, that the main character, I don't think that Lydia would be a person who would see her life as a depressing life, is the interesting thing. I think that she's a person who would look at the things that worked well. And even though the larger picture, you know, is sometimes just not so bright, there were moments of meaning inside that larger picture that, I don't know, made it okay for her. And I think from an outside perspective, we can look and say, oh, my God, you know, whatever happened. But
well, no, what I would say is something still more sweetly heartbreaking,
mm-hmm,
which is that all these little failures, as constant as they may be, are none of them as horrible as the tyranny of plan and order.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the book, you've got a big scheme going on, and in the course of that big and organized scheme, human decisions are made, and Lydia is watching them being made, and they're such awful decisions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's almost as if, wouldn't you rather be a small failure than a big tyrant?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It just seemed to me that one of the messages of the book was that although the little people, and this book is a book that has a certain belief in that kind of sentimental idea, we're
mm-hmm
in South Boston, and, you know, there are the wealthy people across the bridge, and there are the wealthier people still in charge of governments and armies. And, you know, these people, on the one hand, don't have the power to make much of a difference, but on the other, they don't have the power to cause suffering and destruction,
right,
which seems to be, at least the way this book sees it, preferable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here are characters who are pursuing different levels of opportunity,
mm-hmm,
that result in failure.
Right.
Not only result in failure, result in a very odd texture to the novel, because the novel has to start over and over and over again,
right,
as the characters fail and end up at zero again.
Each new start was sort of an ennobling thing, because to my mind, there's nothing more noble in life than the quest to be true to oneself. I think that's, for me, that's the point, like to figure out who you are. And once you figure that out, to try to express that in as honest a way and consistent a way as possible. And I feel that that's what Lydia in this book is trying to do. And she keeps kind of getting, her idea keeps getting kind of foiled by forces larger than her. And so then she starts over and she says, okay, well, it didn't work that way. I'm going to show who I am this way. Okay, that didn't work. I'm going to show who I am this way. That, I can't imagine a norm. That's the way to live. So, I mean, although things don't work out all the time, the fact that she keeps trying, that's to me the point. You know, that's a model for living, is to keep trying. I mean, there's a wonderful quote from Beckett, you know, fail better, you know, if it didn't work, you know, and that's what it's about. And I feel that she's accomplishing that here. She is failing better each time. And that's sometimes all we get, but I think that's enough sometimes.
Now, the book locates itself around a particular moment in American history. America is entering the war. Wilson has announced that America is going to enter. And simultaneously, virtually simultaneously, there is the largest health crisis that America had known up to that point. Is it still the largest?
Yeah, I think if you're talking in just purely domestic terms, I don't think. I mean, the AIDS crisis is also extremely significant. I don't know if you want to do it as a scale over time. I mean, certainly in the compressed period that the flu epidemic happened, we're talking a 4 to 6 month period, it beats everything else. You know, if you're just talking about numbers, I think at this point, you know, there's probably other things that are vying to compete. But
so that you chose a moment in which this larger external agent is going to crush all of the aspirations
right.
of your characters.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting way of thinking. You know, it's like what Samuel Johnson calls the vanity of human wishes,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that there's something larger than these characters that doom their efforts to insignificance. And it is a kind of Beckett idea.
Yeah.
What led you mm-hmm. to build a novel around a thought like that?
Well, I mean, for me, the spark really was learning. I mean, I was just fascinated by the history of this event, like the 1918 epidemic absolutely fascinated me. And I'm not sure I can tell you why it did. I mean, I've always had a morbid streak, and I'm sure that was part of it. I'm a very morbid person, and the idea of this huge thing happening, and also the fact that it, just the scale in which it had been erased from public consciousness was fascinating to me, the fact that I had never heard of it, and I consider myself fairly, you know, well-educated. But I think as it developed, and I've just been actually sort of forming this thought as you've been talking about this, because especially with, like, the war and all that comes in. I started this book in 2000, which was before September 11th, which was before the war in Iraq began, you know, before election number two. And in every case, you know, there I was kind of in an environment where the wills of the people, myself and the people that I knew were being subverted, you know? I mean, you know, there was a war that we didn't want. There was a president that we didn't want. And so I think, you know, and again, this is actually something that's just coming to me right now, but it probably is in there too. Like, I think my fascination with this idea kind of comes from the fact that we're inhabiting a period right now where there's a large portion of the country that's sort of in the same position as a lot of the people in this book are. You know, there's not a whole lot, as, you know, hard as we try, we're not able to make happen the things that we'd like to have happen. So how do you deal with that? How do you live with that? And, you know, I try to write, I think, to help me figure these sorts of things out.
Now, on the human scale, this remedy that Lydia's husband, Henry, develops, as we said, it's not the point. He is going to allow her to invent a formula and even a design. The point will be, as people order, he's going to write consoling letters. But that formula, she's feeling...
She's a bit skeptical.
Well, not only skeptical, eventually she's completely hopeless about it and tells the partner, why don't you carbonate it and just sell it as soda, because it has no nutritive or healthful
right.
value. And he does.
Right.
He does, and she loses her her right to assert her creation of this QD soda, and it has a kind of legendary quality as time goes on. We travel with QD to around 1993, and they're making tours of QD history, and there are people who have the cork-lined bottle caps with the
right.
with more jags, and there too it seems as if what was the impulse there?
The thing that fascinated me most about the whole QD story was the idea that if we tell a lie often enough, we come to believe it ourselves. I was fascinated with the concept of this person, Quentin Driscoll, who I think at heart is not a bad guy, really. I think at heart he actually has a lot in common with Lydia. I think they're both very ambitious, very motivated people. But he makes a couple very bad decisions on both, like, ethical and moral grounds, as well as, you know, commercial, I think, ultimately. And but he manages to convince himself through sheer repetition that he's done no wrong, and he honestly believes that. And I think everyone does that on some level at some point in their lives. There's something that we don't like, or there's something we'd say would be better a certain way, and we repeat the preferred, you know, version to ourselves, and we really do come to believe it. So that was another, to my mind, that was another aspect that the frailness and unreliability of memory is explored, is the idea of making our own myths and then them not being myths anymore.
I'm speaking with Marla Goldberg, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. Marla's new book is Wicket's Remedy, published by Doubleday. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Marla Goldberg about her new novel, Wicket's Remedy. Now, Lydia discovers in the process of bringing a sick child to the hospital, she arrives just around 16 hours before it would have been impossible to bring the child to the hospital, because eventually there are tents and lines and there are no doctors. The nuns are, at best, tucking the patients in. And she decides to volunteer, and in the process she discovers that she is meant to be a nurse. Now, this is a very thematic decision in the book, mm-hmm. because it's not a medicine that causes a cure. It's the intention of the medicine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And similarly, she doesn't have to be trained to be a nurse, although she's going to be. She is a nurse because she feels she is a nurse.
Right, right.
I'm curious about this impulse.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, for, to her mind, she decides that she's meant to be a nurse, but I think it can be generalized. She, up to this point, her life had sort of been, you know, she needed to make money, so she worked in a store, but she hadn't thought, or it had never even occurred to her that there could be more to life than that. And I think it's the experience of being at this hospital, volunteering her services for the first time, to realize that she actually can have agency in the world and have a positive impact on those around her and on the world around her. And I think until that point in her life, it had never even occurred to her that that was a possibility. Culturally, you know, growing up, she grows up in a community. It's a very practical-minded community by necessity. You know, socioeconomics kind of dictates that you don't think about the larger stuff and the larger possibilities. And then she gets to a point where she realizes, oh, there is more to life, and I can do more. And so to her, it comes in the sentence, I am meant to be a nurse. But I think the larger idea is we all can, if we choose, make life a little bit better for those around us. And so that's what it was for me.
From that point on, or at least 30 pages later, the whole style of the book changes. The voice stops being a passive voice. You're not dealing with a, I don't know what to call it, but there was the voice of a hungry child mm-hmm. in the book. Suddenly, she has applied for a job that she would need more experience for, but since there is an epidemic and there are so few nurses, they're willing to take on a nurse's assistant, or not even a
yeah.
nurse's assistant,
yeah.
to aid in this experimental project. Now, you say in your author's note that that project did exist,
mm-hmm.
How did you discover it? Because it seems to me to be a very...
Yeah. I was reading, you know, just a nonfiction book about the flu. I mean, when I, 5 years ago when I was researching this project, I basically read everything in print that had anything to say about the 1918 influenza epidemic. And it was just this throwaway sentence, basically, that mentioned, oh, you know, by the way, experiments were undertaken on human subjects in Boston. And then it moved on. I was like, no, you cannot move on after just blandly a sentence like that. And so I discovered that I just have a passion and a love for research in the process of working on this book, because that gave me, you know, a hunt to undertake. And so I knew I personally just needed to know more about that, just from a personal kind of curiosity basis. But also I thought, man, that'd be a great thing to explore in this book. And so I ended up going to the Library of Congress, where I was able to uncover the actual government document that had been written after these experiments, you know, describing each individual test and the outcome of each test and who was a part of it. And once I had that in my hands, I knew that, you know, I could go from there.
Now, in history, apparently the only one that's trying to study how the flu gets transmitted, and that means that they put the culture down the throat, first in a sugar solution, then in a saline solution, but nothing, no one gets the flu. Mm-hmm. Eventually, by accident, one of the medical doctors, an assistant, gets the flu, and they actually scoop the culture from the back of his throat and even inject his blood, because by this point they're desperate to have a successful experiment.
Yeah.
Money has been put aside for this, and their careers are in some sense resting on. Now, this becomes as terrible as reading about the infected blankets given to Native America. I mean, there's a certain point here where this becomes not just a moral parable, but a moral parable that's unambiguous.
Right.
You know, that something is horrible that happens when people can have their own way.
But the thing that's fascinating is everyone's intention. I mean, the intention was good. I think everyone in that study, even to a large degree, you know, the naval prisoners themselves who had volunteered, they all thought that what they were doing was the good thing. They were fighting the good fight. You know, from their perspective of history, you know, here when we look at these things, we think, oh my goodness, how terrible. But you know, I think the men who volunteered, I mean, one thing I learned about them as I was trying to figure out, you know, what kind of guy is in naval prison, what kind of guy would voluntarily subject themselves, because it was not a Tuskegee situation. I mean, it was informed consent.
But within this novel, which is called Wicket's Remedy, by my guest Myla Goldberg, it seemed to me suddenly that I was reading a book called Wicket's Remedy, in which the point, whether conscious or not, is that very few things have a remedy.
Right.
And very few remedies work.
Yeah.
That when Lydia is applying to get her money, she even says, you know, I don't expect to be a full partner. Just the money is for my contribution. I just want some sense of, but no, in fact, you know, we discover by a letter that even on her deathbed, she's waiting for an answer from this man. No remedy for the flu, no remedy over and over again for death or for heartache or for poverty or for lack of education. The book seems to have at its heart, consciously or unconsciously, to talk about what happens when remedy is unavailable.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And I guess there's two pictures to look at. There's the big picture and there's the small picture. And I guess maybe one of the things that's coming out in this book is let us pay attention to the small picture. The big picture is not something we can control, and it's often a picture we will not like. So, you know, in defense against that, let's think small for a while. And in thinking small, there might be some way to actually manage from day to day.
Because like the earlier book, I think, if you'll pardon me, that you have some kind of instinct that amounts to naturalizing Kafka. That in Kafka, this sense of almost universal mal... I don't even know what to call it. A kind of darkness to the running of things that depends upon some understructure that may not itself be maleficent, but produces maleficence in the human realm. Something like that. And here, it's almost as if, in order to get as far away from the Jewish melancholy of bee season, this is a book of Boston Irish Catholics who have, you know, feelings that confession can, you know, free, that there is a way out from the daily condemnation. And yet, like a fly, you know, or a bee struggling to get out of a spider's web, the book finds itself, nevertheless, for all of its attempts to commit itself to a savior, to a remedy, to some kind of angelic voice of hopefulness through a chorus, it nevertheless finds that the web is there and the fly is caught in the web.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and I think, you know, this probably speaks to, you know, my state of mind, you know, as I was writing it, which, and also just my belief in general. And actually, this is an interesting thing because people have asked me, oh, well, are there parallels between your first book and your second book, between Bee Season and Wicket's Remedy? And at first, you know, my answer was, well, you know, I just wanted Wicket's Remedy to be as different as possible from my first book, which is true. I mean, I really wanted to try to write a book as humanly different as I could because I think it's important to kind of put challenges to myself that way. But I think I've also realized, just as I've thought about it more, that at root there's sort of an underlying belief in both books that the world is a broken place and it is our duty as human beings to try to fix it in any way that we can, any small way. Even if it's a very small thing, it's our duty to do that small thing. In Bee Season, that's what Eliza's doing at the end, I think. She's recognizing the brokenness of the world around her and she's taking a small step to try to remedy, you know, that fracturedness. And I think in Wicket's Remedy, Lydia is, you know, there are so many things that are broken in her world, but, you know, she keeps trying to fix it because that's all that we can do. You know, all we can do is to try to fix some of the stuff that we see broken around us.
I've been speaking with Myla Goldberg, author most recently of Wicket's Remedy, published by Doubleday. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure. You can read an excerpt from Wicket's Remedy on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
You've been listening to KCRW's Bookworm. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Good Food, a weekly exploration of culinary trends, tantalizing recipes, and intriguing discoveries in food and drink. Check out the podcast of Good Food at kcrw.com.